Blog Talk Radio. This podcast is brought to you by the Phantom Gallery Chicago Network, an artist-run project that exhibits in non-traditional gallery settings. The Phantom Gallery looks at how the city influences art and how artists transform the city by contributing to civic dialogue and quality of life. These installations produce creative conversations. I'm your host, Alpha Bhutan. Thank you for listening. Good afternoon and welcome to another creative conversation. Today we have on the line with us our featured artist, Joe Gilmore. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Alpha. How are you today?
I'm fine. I'm just excited and ready to listen to your conversation. And, I want you to be able to tell us about yourself. And I'm interested in your travels and your whole concept of what you do as an artist.
Well, I'll do the best I can. It's a long history, but I'm honored to be here, and I will answer the question to the best of my ability.
Well, actually, the first question you could ask, and it's not really a question, if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Okay. My name is Joseph Gilmore. I am a visual artist. I actually... From childhood, I wanted to be an opera singer, and I also drew, and I studied opera formally, but painting and drawing, I always had mentors who recognized that I was someone that might have potential, and so I got lots and lots of one-on-one grown-up mentorship by masters throughout my life. And at a point, I decided that I was going to focus on my artwork because it was just so easy to be in your studio, just you and the universal energy creating together. You know, you're allowing creative energy to come through you. And when you're doing music, you rely on ensemble and conductors and so forth. And I found that not as intimate as just painting, just creating, sculpting, being there in the moment with the art. And that's where I am now.
So when you talk about, you know, like your childhood, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Florida on the Space Coast, in a little town called Merritt Island. I wanted to, like I said, become an opera singer from the age of three. I was in the Orange Grove. Do not ask me really where I got the idea to be an opera singer, except for I think it might have been Mighty Mouse, Bugs Bunny, some Disney. And then I would watch Ed Sullivan, and there was a coloratura soprano, her name was Roberta Peters, that I loved from very small age. And people in my community didn't get it, but at that time I was going to a segregated school, and the teachers treated you like you were their child, so a lot of the teachers understood, and they promoted me and encouraged me. But once we went to the integrated schools, which is about 1967, that promotion by my teachers of me as a potential next Paul Ropes acting would have been more like a Roland Hayes, because I was a tenor. It ceased. But then I picked it up on my own. I cut yards to earn money, and I paid for my own vocal training. And at the same time, however, I was being mentored as a painter. There was a woman at my church.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. You were getting ready to tell us about your mentor.
Oh, there was a woman at my church who volunteered, I think it's a docent at a local museum. And I was exposed to lots of art in her home. She was well-to-do. I was exposed to El Greco, who I love, Modigliani, Picasso, various artists, and we would have discussions. And then there was another woman at my church who was actually an art teacher. She would take me to community college on weekends to study art, just to sit in. And I would do lots of art with her in her home. Then once I grew up, I went to music school in Florida, Stetson University. I kind of let go of the painting for a minute. Then I to Syracuse, and Syracuse had this wonderful program at the Community Folk Art Gallery that was totally free. It was funded by the university, and you could just go there and create, and there were all these master's level students and master artists who would just teach you how to paint. They would teach you color theory. They would teach you, you'd let you know what was working. Critique is a good, I'm really into receiving critiques, and they were very good at that. And it was all free. And that was really the beginning of me taking my art seriously, because I got such positive feedback from the instructors, I'm going to say, at the Syracuse Community Folk Art Gallery, and it's still there. So then I began
with
to
that. You began with that. Did you go and pursue in your college life? Did you pursue, the arts?
I did not. I actually exhibited a lot from that point in Syracuse. I exhibited at Colgate University, Ithaca College, the Empire State Building. World Trade Center, the governor's office. I went to school for sociology, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of had a heavy concentration in African and African American history, which absolutely influences my art tremendously. So that's what I got my degrees in. But at the same time, I was mentored by painters. My last master painter was an African American gentleman. His name is Gerald Glover. He paints in the old European master style. And he saw my work at an exhibit, and he came over to me and he said, "This is the best work here. You must come to my studio." And I was like, "Well, what's this guy asking me to come to the studio for? This is odd." And I went there. I was blown away. The work, the quality of his work, his technique is just phenomenal. And he shared with me lots of things. He taught me about painting skin. I had, maybe you were going to ask me about this in my travels, but right after I met Joe, I went to Senegal with my son, and I experienced black skin for the first time, and I mean black skin. Got home, and beautiful, beautiful, beautiful black people. And I got home and I said, it's more than, I was inspired actually. There was like a spiritual thing that occurred to me on Gory Island. But once I got home, I said, I have to paint what I feel, what I saw, what I heard. And that meant painting what I call the root mother of the African-American people who were brought here as a result of the transatlantic slave trade, the African diaspora. And that mother, in my mind, was jet black, just like the people I saw in Senegal, with yellow highlights in their skin. I didn't know how to paint that color. And I called Gerald. I said, "Gerald, I just came back from Africa, and I want to paint people the way I saw them." I said, I saw black skin, really black skin, for the first time in my life, everywhere. And he said, "Well, if there's a lot of blue." I said, "No, I saw yellow. I saw lots of yellow in that black skin." And he said, he told me what colors to mix. He said, I think he said ultramarine blue and burnt sienna. Well, I didn't have any ultramarine blue, but I had another blue, so I improvised. And I was just, my first, I called them the Mama Gorays. And it's from my Ancestors Are Beautiful series. My first Mama Goray was just organic and beautiful, and she was so lovely and jet black. And my concept was, since they were not told they were beautiful in their lifetimes, I felt like a spiritual pull to paint them as they are now in heaven or paradise or wherever we want to call the afterlife, and as kings and queens and gloriously attired and accessorized and their true beauty being shown. And I thought, well, people are going to say, how is that your African ancestor when they look so beautiful? And it came to me, well, that misery that we undoubtedly, the ancestors undoubtedly suffered in this part of the world, it's been painted over and over. I'm painting their spiritual selves now, and they're not beat down now. They're gloriously happy every time one of us goes back to Africa. That's exactly how I felt, particularly to West Africa.
Well, so that's two things I want to ask you about, you know, because you kind of jumped, you know, over it when you started talking about your travels to the African continent. But tell me about how that happened, how that came about, your first trip going back to, you know, the continent.
That happened because I was at a dinner party for a woman here in New York. She's since passed. Her name was Evelyn Cunningham, and she was quite an outstanding figure. She was in the Rockefeller administration, and she was a friend of Brooke Astor. And don't ask me how I wound up at her house, except for I had a friend who was a good friend of hers. And Evelyn had come to my apartment for dinner once, and she was so impressed. She called me at my desk at work, and she said, oh, when can you come to my house and cook? And I said, Evelyn, anytime. And she was 89 at that point. And Evelyn had all of these powerful, powerful young black women who I call Evelyn acolytes. They were at the top of their game. Some of them were even like super delegates in the Obama election. They were like managing directors and vice president. They were the heavy hitters of the New York City and probably world scene of black, strong, powerful, professional black women. And at one of those dinners that I cooked, they would call it Evelyn's Round Table, there was a woman who had just gotten back from Senegal. And she was quite wealthy, actually. People don't know that there's a lot of black money in Harlem, but oh my God. But that's not the point. The point is, she was so excited about Senegal that she could not stop talking about Gorée Island. And she had on all of this beautiful jewelry, and all the women at the table, they were like, where did you get that? And she was just glowing. And I had known this woman for a while, but she was transformed into a being of ancestral light. And she so inspired me by her story that I said, as soon as I get some money, I'm going to go to Senegal. And so it happened. I came into a little extra money. And I have two children. My daughter was married and had little babies at the time, or else I would have invited her on the trip. But my son was 24, and we had traveled a lot anyways. But I called him up and I said, look, come, and this is on the spur of the moment, but I had the money and I just kept hearing this little small voice saying, okay, you got some money, go to Africa, go to Senegal. So I called him up. I said, my kid, I said, listen, come to New York and bring your passport. Because he lives in upstate New York, and I'm in the New York City area. And he says, where are we going to go, Daddy? I said, we're going to Africa. He's like, no way. I said, just come. So I booked our tickets the long way around. I didn't know you could just go from JFK to Senegal and be there in like in 8 hours. People don't know that. We went from Newark to Brussels, and then from Brussels into Dakar, which is just crazy. But it was what we needed to do, apparently. And once we landed in Dakar, like I said, I saw black people everywhere. I mean, jet black people. I didn't know that skin color existed. And then I said, oh, well, number one, we're all mixed. And number two, this is why they say black people. And we were so well received. And it's a French-speaking country, but there's lots of people that speak English, especially in hotels. You know, you can get a guide and a driver and so forth to take you around. You know, I had my kid with me, so I wasn't going to do anything too risky because it was the first time I had been to Africa. And, you know, they say all kinds of bad stuff about Africa, which is just a shame because it's gorgeous. Just everywhere I've been on the continent, it's so gorgeous. And they all, you know, Senegal has its own flavor and so forth, and every other country has their thing. But to answer the question, I was inspired by a woman at a dinner party to go to Africa. To go to Dakar and to Gori Island.
So that really was a really interesting story about, you know, how we can use creative capital, and creative capital can be explained by how we enter different social circles and we use that capital of the people within those circles. So, you know, you dropped a lot of names in this, you know, in going through not even amazing your life, but it's like you said, it's amazing how you're coming into social circles by way of introduction and to get somewhere where the Rockefeller and in the political realm. You as an artist in those spaces, you know, can you talk about that? Because I think that a lot of times artists go into these spaces and, you know, and people are easily invite us into those spaces because they're really interested and intrigued with our life, you know, and how that, actually the question is, how does that influence your art, you know, and when did you find time and did you find a collector base in this sphere of people?
Well, my best friend at the time, her brother is, I don't mean to sound like I'm dropping names. This is just the truth. My best friend at the time, her brother is a major player on the world stage of business. Major. And I won't say what his name is because that doesn't have anything to do with it. And as a result of our friendship, she's also an artist. I was brought into circles that she was, that were just part of her life. And I mean, I've had dinner at the Rockefeller estate because of her. And I've had, I met Evelyn because of her. And as far as how one is received as an artist in those situations, some of the people that I met were like on the board of major art institutions. So they were quite familiar and supportive of the arts, and particularly of the African-American artists. For instance, Evelyn had been on the board of the Schomburg at one point. Then I met another woman, Mrs. Michelle, who is dynamic to this day. Harriet Michelle, she's phenomenal, and she's so earthy, and she's a collector of mine, and she welcomed me, and she was so warm towards me, And I think what happens is people who love art, love artists. They just the social economic levels drop because people don't expect artists to be rich, but they expect artists to be talented. I had a friend, another friend, and I'm not name dropping, but this was like my best friend and cheerleader. His name was Wesley Tan. He was the first and only black fashion designer to have a showroom on, what's that, 7th Avenue, Fashion Avenue. He designed for Mrs. Kennedy when she was pregnant with her children. And we met through Evelyn Cunningham. And I was having a really down day at one point. And Wesley was quite old. He and his sister were almost like my family. The sister was like 80. Mrs. Blair was in her 80s. And she's older than Wesley. And he was in his 80s. But they made me feel like family. And I was down one day because some people were being really mean to me. And Wesley said, "Joe, it's the talent. It's the talent. Don't worry about anything else. Focus on your talent." And so I think that that's what we have to do. We're not going to be the favorites of everybody. We're not going to match the taste points of everybody. Some people love realism. Some people love abstract. Some people want the work to be technically perfect. I tend to be someone who loves whimsy. You know, I can paint things rather technically perfect if I choose, but my spirit is one of joyfulness and whimsy, and even painting work that's really strong, has a strong message. It tends to look as if it's like benign non-threatening. I got a show in the Netherlands as a result of that. This woman that I met there was curator of an art institute, and she said she visited the New York City, and another artist of mine who's also from the Netherlands said that the woman was coming to town and she wanted to see a few artists, and I was one of them. So she and her family, they came to my home, and this place, my apartment, it looks like art gallery. I would love to get rid of a lot of this stuff. So tell people they can buy my art. But anyway.
And where could they, since you're doing a PSA, what's your website and how can they, that way people could go and take a look?
My website is jmacart1.com.
Okay,
they can take a look there. Back to the whimsy and the strength and the strong topics at the same time. So this woman was Dutch. She came and she looked at all my art, and there's a series that I do that's part of the ancestors are beautiful, but it's Jim Crow series, and I take a photo of my great grandparents and their children, and I think they sat for it on Sunday because they were dressed up, and they were in Georgia. I think it was Moultrie, Georgia, where they lived, because that's where my grandmother was born. And it's been around my family forever. But after I came back from Senegal and started the Mama Gori series, which was difficult. It was, I wanted to have fun. So I had learned how to paint on glass, and they were talking about it in Senegal everywhere I went, to how a popular reverse glass painting was, or the technique was. We have a friend here who's a master of reverse glass paintings, and I learned it from him. So after I finished Mama Gore, one night I was just exhausted, and I said, I got to have some fun. And I saw a picture frame. So I drew my Jim Crow ancestors. They were the Johnson family. I drew them. And they were both named Willie. Willie was the husband, and Willie Essie was the wife. And they were my maternal grandmother's parents. And then this is on reverse glass. And typically they use tempera for reverse glass paintings, but I had acrylic paint, and I used acrylic paint, and I was just having such a fun time. It was just so easy, and blah, 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 and the colors. I enjoyed it so much. I didn't expect anything to be, you know, to come of it. And when I flipped it the next day, it was gorgeous. And so out of that, it was right around the time Senator Obama became President Obama. And I was so, so very, like most of us of color, I was so very emotionally touched by that. And then I was looking at the painting of my, the photo of my great-grandparents, and I thought to myself, they would never have imagined that a colored man would be the president of the United States, or a Negro. I'm sure that's what they would, those are the terms that they would have used. And I had saved newsprint from the articles leading up to the election. So I started doing a collage type of reverse glass painting series where I would use the newsprint from when Senator Obama, who then became President Obama, and Mrs. Obama, their whole ascent to power and the glorious beings that they became to all of us. I mean, I love them. But at the same time, I painted my great grandparents, and I just would lay them on top of, lay the glass painting on top of the newsprint. It was like a historical document at that point. It's like I'm documenting history because I love history and sociology, like I said. And then they started, well, not they started, people have cell phones. So the documentation of black people being abused by the police and various other people started appearing in the newspaper. And when little boy in Ohio, I think his name was Tamir Rice, when they killed him on the playground, I thought I was going to lose my mind. And I believe that this little boy who just had a toy gun was shot by the police who could not even perceive him as a child. And so I started documenting incorporating those articles into my paintings of my great grandparents that look very whimsical. But when you look at what's going on in the newsprint, you realize that this is strong stuff. And then actually, I think my subconscious takes over because when I look at some of the pictures of my great grandparents and their children, they have these expressions on their faces like, we just can't believe this is going on still. And so when the woman from the Netherlands, she saw that, she says, oh, your work is very strong, but it's kind, which I mean, I don't know if I intended that. I don't hate people. But
I think that answered the question that I was going to ask you, and because we're down to a few seconds. And that is the question I was going to ask you was, what responsibility do artists have to display the times in their art? And I think that the conversation that we just had and you explaining, you know, how the overlapping of history, you know, and you just answered that question. So, you know, it's really been a delight talking with you, Joe. We're coming down to the end of our show. And again, thank you for doing this. And we look forward to future conversations with you and your work.
Well, and I'm so grateful to you for inviting me to be interviewed by you today, and so that I can tell people what I love and what I do.
This podcast is brought to you by the Phantom Gallery Chicago Network, an artist-run project that exhibits in non-traditional gallery settings. The Phantom Gallery looks at how the city influences art and how artists transform the city by contributing to civic dialogue and quality of life. These installations produce creative conversations. I'm your host, Alpha Bhutan. Thank you for listening.